Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this very special edition of the program. AIDS, a Second Opinion. Deconstructing the Myth of HIV, Part 6. I received an email today from my sources who keep me up to date on what's happening internationally on the war on AIDS. And it's from Geneva, Associated Press writer Naomi Copeland. It says, quote, more than 36 million people worldwide will be infected with the HIV virus, the virus that causes AIDS, by the end of this year, including an estimated 5.3 million new cases, the World Health Organization said Friday. The biggest impact of the disease was in Africa again, according to figures released by the UN Health Agency. Globally, it's estimated 3 million people will die from AIDS in 2000, 80% of them in Africa. Last year, 2.6 million people died of AIDS. Quote, although only about one-tenth of the world's population lives there, sub-Saharan Africa remains the hardest-hit region, accounting for 72% of the people infected with HIV during year 2000, according to the World Health Organization epidemiological records. What if everything I just read you was incorrect? Not in how I read it, but in all of the statements. What if we could challenge, legitimately with facts, not supposition, that there are not 36 million people infected with HIV, that it is not a virus proven to cause AIDS, that we do not have 2.6 million people who have died of AIDS last year, and that the World Health Organization has its own agenda? That is the purpose of 15 years of in-depth investigation that has led to this report. Today, I'm going to take you on a journey that will challenge just the underlying scientific basis of AIDS. I want to begin with a discussion of ideas about scientists who bandy about all forms of conjecture. Only toward the end of my discussion will the relevance of this topic to our general theme, the existence of HIV, become clear. I will, of necessity, have to go into some depth on a scientific basis, but I will certainly at all times summarize it so that you'll keep it well in mind. If I do not go at this level, at this depth, then those people who have lived off the HIV myth will continue to do so. And the average person, feeling overwhelmed by not understanding the science of virology and disease, will be left to accept, as this reporter, Naomi Copeland, did, reporting without challenge through Associated Press, as the New York Times, Time Magazine, all the other media will report without challenge everything they're told from the orthodox scientific community. I'm merely offering them a challenge, something they should welcome. After all, if they really believe that HIV is the cause of AIDS, they have isolated this virus, and then it's going to kill everyone that it infects, then they should feel very comfortable having someone like myself or others who feel that they have misled us, have got it all wrong, welcome the opportunity. Because if we cannot find weaknesses in their theories, if we cannot show the limitations in their scientific approach, then maybe they're absolutely right, in which case we look wrong, and therefore they have even greater support. In laboratory life, we saw the authors depicted the best scientists as consummate politicians, as well as extraordinary researchers. If we went a little further in paging through Thoreau's Aviaire to study his work, The Pasteurization of France, we would see that he applies his concept of what a scientist does both retroactively and frenetically. Just as Pasteur is head and shoulders in scientific stature above the more run-of-the-mill scientist viewed in laboratory life, which is a prominent book on the subject, So he towers over them in his degree of political hyperactivity. Pasteur's portrait might cause us to rethink my earlier assertion that the opening image of Gallo, flashbulbs popping as he spoke at a Bethesda French restaurant about how he discovered the cause of AIDS, that was in part one of this series, that this was something new to science, that suddenly we had one of our leading scientists, Gallo, at the National Cancer Institute, say the probable cause, with all this hyperbole, no hyperbole, self-interest, politicalization, creating a whole dynamic around one's personality, irrespective of what they're creating scientifically, has always been with us. One of the most pervasive images of the scientists and the public's unconscious is that of Dr. Frankenstein. Shorn of his criminal activities, such a grave robbing, he is a rather idealized figure in that he is working on his experiments out of a pure love of the game. He is not out to win points with colleagues who have laughed at him or to please grant givers. He is pouring his own fortune into his laboratory. Although he does hanker after fame, he's not looking for material success and is driven ultimately by a Prothean urge to penetrate the secrets of life. Such scientists have long ceased to exist, if they ever did. Latour, in his depiction of Pasteur, renders a 3D portrait of the contemporary practitioner. Pasteur is not a Renaissance man, but one could say that he is tripatriate. As a professional, he was equal part scientist, networker, and publicist. He did make groundbreaking discoveries, and once these were made, he began heating up the environment around him, beating the drum to make his new practice acceptable to the public, while intensively cajoling, flattering, and threatening political supporters so as to for them to form into a broad sporting coalition. Regardless of the fact that he was making genuine scientific breakthroughs, while I believe those who have claimed to pinpoint HIV as the cause of AIDS were not making such advances, both he and they follow the same public relations strategy. The initial insight is quickly set in stone, and all doubts about what they've done are forbidden. Reservations or doubts, though they may be of value for a scientist, are anathema for advertising and self-promotion. I would like to go at Latour's idea in two steps. First, I'll question his basic position, which holds that good science can be created in the midst of a three-ring circus, as if it were. Then, retracting my ground a little, I will ask whether it is possible that Latour's portrait could apply to scientists in non-critical moments of research, but not at moments when paradigms are in flux. The first point, that Latour's type of opinion should be rejected altogether, is held by many dissenters. They argue that as mainstream scientists are involved, to one degree or another, in creating a heroic media image along with doing hard science, it is up to those of us who are more concerned with the search for truth than reputation to make clear that it is not the amount of fanfare a discovery manages to sustain, but its ability to be proven in light of the most stringent possible test and to sustain itself against practical and interpretive criticism that will prove it right. Dr. Stefan Lanka, who I've interviewed many times on this program, brings out what he sees as the heavy cost of being swayed by belief in a theory that has found great success and popularity in the media, in lieu of its being proven by its mettle in the laboratory. He, of course, is a professor of virology and is possibly the most outspoken of all the critics to the current AIDS paradigm. I give you that as background because Stefan Lanka was also not allowed the opportunity at a recent International AIDS Symposium to offer his critique or criticism of the existing paradigm to any of the members, including Dr. Wu and of the mainstream community, Dr. Robert Gallo. These people wanted nothing to do with him, would not entertain his challenge. Yet the media was not aware of that. The media, I assume, has been of the proclivity that clearly everyone agrees HIV has been discovered, is the cause of AIDS, and let's get beyond that argument. to looking at vaccines and drugs that can help once you're infected. They have not gone back, as Lanka has done, and others that you will hear about in a few moments, to say, well, hold on, you say you've found the virus? What if you have not found the virus? What if it's not HIV that's causing people to get sick? Then virtually everything that you've done after that will fail. And that is what Lanka has been willing to do. He is speaking of how the fight against AIDS has hinged on a belief in the existence of HIV, which belief stands on a very shaky collection of unstable premises. For example, he says, quote, the AIDS myth, with its exploitation of the fear of an alleged deadly sex plague, has been blindly launched into the realm of seemingly scientifically based biology through the pseudo-rational HIV detection technique, meaning the HIV antibody test. That is, the claim to have isolated HIV through new, previously unapproved methods, unquote. But the two terms HIV and AIDS, according to the rules of construction depending upon each, the clarification of the question whether HIV exists with the most secure method of identification available, and this would be the only isolation of complete HIV viruses, is a sine qua non for dismantling the mass delusional trance called AIDS. In other words, the edifice of belief constructed around AIDS, which Lanka sees as containing as much disabling falsehoods as verity, has as its core element an abiding faith in the never-yet-substantiated retrovirus HIV. In his opinion, if people saw how checkered and inconclusive is the history of scientists trying to isolate this will-o'-the-wisp, they would be revamping all their ideas about AIDS. He says, quote, that HIV has never been identified as secure biological matter is of the greatest importance and must immediately be told to every stigmatized person. No HIV, no false diagnosis, no AIDS, no death sentence, no false treatment, no unnecessary suffering, no needless dying, but new chances for people who for complex reasons got seriously ill, amongst them being labeled as AIDS cases and HIV positives as well, and then falling victim to medical short-sightedness based upon laboratory technical constructs, unquote. However, let me play devil's advocate a moment and accept that Latour's view has some validity. That is, I'm accepting that backbiting, currying favor, chasing the limelight, trying to get the Nobel Prize, wanting to be rich, wanting to be famous, and such other unsavory traits may play a part in advancing science, particularly with the Latour-Wolfgar thesis added that all the individual scientist ploys to increase his or her credibility will only pan out if the science being advanced through them is good. I still maintain the situation is of limited application to a certain paradigm. Meaning, in just straight lay language, that if an individual was had the most egregious personality, was offensive in the extreme, had no sensibilities or sensitivities towards anyone, was ultimately selfish, but as long as what they created helped people and was proven, then that's all that matters. We can like or dislike a person on a personal level. We can respect or challenge their motives, but as long as what they create helps us, we can have the benefit of that without having to respect or like their methods of how they achieved it or them personally. But what if someone had all the worst of these qualities, arrogance, boundless ego, and did not have the creation that could withstand the test of time? Then we would have an altogether different view of that person and all the other people who supported that person and benefit from that person. That's what Dr. Thomas Kuhn had to say about paradigms, scientific paradigms in particular, and how they're developed. Thomas Kuhn wrote a remarkable book. It's called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. His fundamental insight, which everyone cites, is that an older paradigm, an older belief system, a way of doing things, like the Inquisition, like for 250 years, a single book was used both in Europe and the United States in identifying the four traits that made someone a witch. And no matter what level of society, what your educational background, what your position of power within the community, this book superseded everyone else's input. And it was only when they finally gave up this book that we started to see an end to witchcraft and the Inquisition against women and the entire Inquisition itself. But for over 250 years, from 1486 when that particular book came out, until well into the 1700s, that was the book that was used. In fact, more than 19 witches were burned or killed in New England out of some 200 who were identified as witches. Those that said that they were a witch were pardoned, because the Puritans didn't believe that if a person pardoned themselves and returned to God, that they should be killed. But those who affirmed their truth, that they were not witches, well, then they were killed. And it was only, and it was the book that allowed them to do that. That's called a paradigm. So everyone believes in it. And no matter how illogical, irrational, no one will challenge it, because everyone benefits from that singular belief. So that's just a simple, or another way in our more current model is taking tamoxifen to prevent cancer in a family where there's been no history of cancer. There's no science whatsoever to support it. None. I've reviewed all the literature. I've shared that in a separate investigative report on this program on iatrogenic episodes. I've cited dozens of studies from peer-reviewed journals showing there's no proof that that will work. In fact, it actually increases cancer. But it's part of a paradigm. A scientific paradigm. Hence, hundreds of thousands of doctors will believe in it, will not challenge it, because it is the accepted paradigm. So therefore, it's only 10, 20 years from now, when there's a shift in the paradigm, that then they'll let go of that belief of suggesting or insisting women receive this. Mandatory vaccinations, another paradigm. No matter how many articles I can read on the air and show you by my special investigative reports on vaccinations of why it is unscientific, it does not, it cannot be proven who it will protect, nor can it show who it will hurt. It will still be used because it's a part of the medical paradigm, and therefore it will not be challenged. The assumption by every pediatrician is, if I'm given a schedule of 22 injections, inoculations I have to give the child before the age of 5, they will get them. They will not look at the child or the outcome from the child. In time, it will always be something else they believe that caused the child to have a problem, not the vaccines. They'll never accept responsibility. There will never be a mea culpa for having engaged in a bad paradigm. So why should it be such a stretch of the imagination when we have engaged in the folly of tens of thousands of paradigms? Slavery was a paradigm. Genetic superiority, a paradigm. Eugenics, a paradigm. These are paradigms where the best and brightest also are caught up in it. So what I'm suggesting is that we take a careful look at what Thomas Kuhn said in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where old paradigms that are wrong, that are dangerous, still maintain power. And it is this older paradigm, such as the polemic idea that the sun revolves around the earth, becomes weak and has to be abandoned when too many anomalies begin to crop up. But that takes time. Too many astronomical events clash with the worldview, and scientists begin to doubt its validity. Up to this point, there has not been adequate challenge within the scientific community to doubt the validity of HIV equaling AIDS equaling death. The challenge has been outside of the scientific community, because one of the things paradigms do is exclude anyone who would challenge it. Therefore, the debate is never, are we doing something right? How do we know we've actually discovered HIV? Have you ever taken HIV out of any of your patients' blood? No, you haven't. No scientist has. No doctor has. If you doubt me, go into any medical office, go into any morgue, ask any medical examiner. You had a patient die of AIDS. Find it in his blood. Look in his lymph glands. Look in his spleen, his bone marrow. Look everywhere in his body. No one has ever found the HIV in the blood. Now, if he died of hepatitis, load with hepatitis. Died of influenza, you'll find it all over the body. If he has herpes, all over the body. Epstein-Barr virus, all over the body. Well, how is it that with all other viruses, we can easily find it in a live or dead person? But what we're calling the major killer of the century, we can't find it. But that argument has not yet been done because no mainstream medical or scientific journal has allowed any of the hundreds of articles submitted to it that would challenge it to be published. And I have kept in contact with thousands of leading Nobel laureates and dissenters who say where they've published hundreds of papers in mainstream journals, The Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, not once were their articles challenging the existing paradigm of HIV existence allowed to be published. So there's massive censorship by the paradigm to prevent people from having an opportunity to know the full dynamics of an argument. Just as could you imagine the difference in a presidential election if Ralph Nader had been given an opportunity with every debate to have participated equally? Would we have had the outcome of this election? Would their votes have been cast at about 96% of the American population voting for one of two candidates? Highly improbable. A further point made by Dr. Kahn is the one not often cited. It is that abandonment of an insufficient paradigm is not usually an orderly process whereby the old guard gracefully concedes that they were wrong and jettisons their view. No, women do not suffer from the condition called hysteria, but for 100 years they were told they did, and their ovaries were removed because doctors were absolutely certain, the best and brightest in America, that hysteria resided from the ovaries. And they would put the ovaries in formaldehyde bottles and put them on women's shelves to say, see, you no longer suffer from hysteria. Women actually prided themselves in showing their ovaries in bottles to show there's no hysteria in our household. That is how strong a belief can be. Now today, would your doctor say you suffer from hysteria? Your argumentative nature, which was one of the three diagnostic criteria, along with insomnia and depression, that your husband told us about, and the husband was allowed to make the diagnosis. It was not the doctor. So if you argued with your husband, you were told you had a disease. And by removing your ovaries and frequently your clitoris and put them in a formaldehyde bottle, you no longer had this condition. So what if you went into a physician today on Park Avenue and say, my wife is arguing with me. I believe she has hysteria. I want her ovaries removed and her clitoris removed so we can put it on our mantle to show that we are a right home. What would the physician do? Say, fine, we agree. It's a matter of medical fact that women do suffer from this condition, men do not, and you do have a right to make this diagnosis, and it is the treatment of choice. Would that doctor also have said, we'll also give you opium, the most commonly given prescription for women in the 1800s, right up through the 1900s, to help calm her nerves? Or would the doctor have handed her multiple issues, the Journal of the American Medical Association, suggesting that women should smoke, because it calms their nerves? Nerves that men could calm because of their masculine tendency towards logic and reason, but women could not, even those who had had their ovaries removed. You would say, well, that's just crazy. But because we've surrendered one paradigm does not mean any that we've accepted in its place is all that much better. I could show you things that are absurd today, like taking completely healthy women's breasts off in preventative mastectomies, when it's never been determined that there is an absolute genetic consequence for breast cancer. And even if there were, there are lifestyle modifications that could clearly prevent it. But why would a surgeon take a breast off of a healthy woman and her daughter, which they're doing all over the place now? It's a very common operation, and women are bragging about it. We don't have the chance of dying of breast cancer in the future because we've had our breasts, healthy breasts, removed. Any difference between that woman today and a woman who prided herself on her ovaries being removed in the 1800s? Does it mean that the woman won't die of colorectal cancer, or thyroid cancer, or brain cancer, stomach cancer, liver cancer, pancreatic cancer? No, it doesn't. So it's not just the woman who is engaged in a paradigm, but the scientists, the hospital, the insurance companies, everyone engages. And it will be years before that one dies out. Kahn poses the paradigm shift as based on both scientific and social grounds. While he identifies the social component as generational changes, other research links the support of alternative paradigms to different social groups. Everett Mendelsohn states, quote, "The activities that scientists carry out are socially structured activities and are therefore related to social interest," unquote. These interests extend from the type we saw attributed to the retroviruses, defense and aggrandizement of their scientific specialty, to broader direct social influences and interests such as religion, social class, or political position, unquote. When two paradigms are in opposition, like alternative and mainstream, like eating hamburger and being a vegetarian, like preventing a disease versus wanting to get the latest scientific treatment, scientists and others cling to either one depending upon these interests. In relation to recent scientific controversies in the United States, such as those over cancer treatment, Ronald Guerra says, quote, "The most likely source of the increasing controversy is a divergence in relevant values between those who were in fact making the decisions, such as the establishment scientists and their journalist colleagues, and sizable groups in the population at large, such as people with AIDS. Each backs one of the conflicting paradigms. I'll temporarily hold back on discussion of the content of the paradigm I see emerging in the alternative health movement. But what I said in the previous programs about the democratic processes that should be existing in the AIDS movement, where their supporters should have the right to look at new perspectives, and are limited or non-existent. I'm instead going to talk about the politicking, grandstanding scientist who fits within the bounds of the old boys network, such as Robert Gallo, such as that often found among AIDS orthodoxy, almost exclusively. It seems less applicable as a model of the relations within the more democratic, multicultural, alternative organizations we have witnessed in such phenomena as community-based treatment. There, science has advanced through more cooperative action. This takes us to our last point, returning us to the topic of AIDS or HIV's existence. In discussing evidence for and against HIV, I highlighted Dr. Peter Duisberg's attempt to overturn Koch's postulates. Koch, by the way, was a great scientist, medical doctor, who said before something can cause a disease, it has to meet certain criteria. And since that time, virtually all of disease has been measured against Koch's postulates. Just to give you an example of what that means. For something to cause a disease in a group, it has to be able to be found in the group. It's like if you say that a bullet shot from a gun killed a person, you have to be able to find a bullet hole and B, a bullet or fragment of bullet. If you say the person was shot 27 times and died from gunshot wounds, but you can find no bullet holes, no entry, no exit, and no bullet, then how could you be sure that it was a bullet that did it? And that's one of Koch's postulates. You also must have something there in adequate amounts. If you say that a person was stabbed to death, therefore you're going to make the knife the cause of the effort to stop people from being stabbed, but then you look at the body and you find that, well, the knife didn't penetrate the skin. It kind of bounced off. It was a rubber knife. Well, then you say, well, how'd they then die of stab wounds? Well, that's what the argument is when it comes to AIDS. We have not challenged it. So Duisberg would simply say, hey, test HIV against Koch's postulates. And I want to stress that the debate over AIDS has a marked tendency to move from argument over fine details to a probing of the deepest fundamentals of science. When such a tendency surfaces, I propose this registers that an issue stands abridge the basic question of the validity of the dominant paradigm of science. Even beyond its presentation of colossal health risks and scientific puzzle, AIDS is an extremely sensitive topic, since many of the difficulties it raises seem to suggest as part of their solution the overturning of the existing philosophy of biomedicine. In effect, 2 or 3 million people would be put out of business. Enormous litigation would occur. Do you have any idea how many people would be sued? How many medical organizations, physicians, AIDS activists, magazines? If it turns out that I'm right, others are right, and that virtually everything you've been told about AIDS is wrong? Let me stop there for a moment. For those of you who just joined us, I'm Gary Nall, part 6 of AIDS, A Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth of HIV. When I reach the end of this critique, I will make concrete points about where the AIDS controversy has exposed key weaknesses of the establishment's paradigm, their beliefs. First, let me turn to the thorny topic of language. It is not ill, said by Plato, quote, that he is to be held as a god who knows well how to define and to divide, unquote. Let's look at the new organon. Even if the existence of the retrovirus HIV was disproven, this would not lessen the number of people getting sick with AIDS, but it would redirect research in a new and hopefully more productive direction. Moreover, it is also possible to lessen the numbers affected. That is, it is possible that if we look closely at the statistics of those who are counted as having AIDS, we might find that they are not as awesome as we have been led to believe. We've already noted that AIDS tests are regularly rendered false positives. Moreover, we've seen that especially in Africa, presumptive diagnoses are rife. No one's had the blood actually taken from the patient. These people are suffering in sub-Saharan Africa from massive civil war. They have been refugees for years. They do not have adequate or clean drinking water or food. They're suffering from dysentery, cholera, parasites, malaria, tuberculosis. And if we were to look and diagnose each one of them based upon those diseases, then we would have virtually no AIDS. We've simply redefined all these other already existing, historically existing diseases as AIDS purely by presumptive diagnosis. Oh, so you're losing weight. Oh, you have diarrhea. Oh, you have non-productive dry cough. Well, then you have AIDS. No, you have tuberculosis. You have malaria. You have gross malnutrition. So that's what I'm talking about presumptive diagnosis. And so if you look at it from that point of view, if you have cases in which a person who dies of a disease that can be associated with AIDS is presumed to have the syndrome and classified as such without administering any test of HIV positivity or other factors, that would make the categorization reasonable. On the rest of this program, the focus is on how different agencies arrive at the figures of how many are suffering from AIDS. And that brings me back to what I said at the beginning of the program, where I was reading a press release that was based purely upon fictional information from the World Health Organization. Why is it that there are sudden boosts and occasionally even dips in these figures? In the 1980s and early 90s, one of the periodically alarming moments in the AIDS drama came when the CDC released new calculations about how many people had the disease. And the number was seen to have dramatically and unexpectedly, given previous projections, increased. The media would ballyhoo these frightening numbers as signs that the unstoppable AIDS plague is scathing more than thought possible, and so it would be reported the situation is growing ever more dire. I will try to erase some of these startling numbers, not because I'm in any way want to lessen the seriousness of the crisis, but to show that this is yet another area in which sensationalism seems to have shunted aside sane science. On the surface, it might seem foolhardy to think one could merely look at reports on paper without re-examining patients and arrive at a different conclusion. Yet this attempt seems less delusive as soon as it is borne in mind that there have been continual problems in deciding just who has AIDS. To repeat some basics, people never, ever, ever die of AIDS directly. Their immune systems are weakened enough so that they are brought low by another disease. Think what this may mean to specific borderline cases. There are many diseases in which the immune system weakens. It's the trademark of almost every devastating illness. If we think of all who have died of illness, we could say it's hardly feasible to test this whole population post-mortem for the presence of HIV. The only people who are likely to be tested are those who went down from the disease, like PCP or pneumocystis crini pneumonia, which are strongly correlated with AIDS. Fine, but what if, as happens regularly, it's suddenly found that a new disease, one that was not thought to be related to AIDS, is found to be so related? What would one do in terms of classification about all those patients who died from this disease over the last few years? Short of exhumating them, it would be impossible to determine whether they died of what it is said on their original death certificates or whether they died from AIDS. I only bring this up, this hypothetical case, to show that the questions involving the decision whether a person has AIDS are far messier than those that come up around other diseases. If you die of heart disease, you die of a stroke. There's no question that it was a blood clot in your brain that caused the stroke. If you die of a massive heart attack, an ischemic episode, there's no question of that. They can show it through the pathology of the heart. If you die of viral meningitis, they can show it in the brain. If you die of, a hepatitis, they can show the effects upon the liver directly. If you die of AIDS, they can't show it. They have to show some other disease that you died of, but they never attribute it to the other disease. They attribute it to AIDS. That's what I'm talking about. On a previous program, I descended to the level of the cell and particle to take note of how some evidence for the existence of HIV retrovirus was based upon a perversion of, or more charitably, a rewriting of the rules of viral isolation. In this section, I will ascend to the study of large masses of people. Notice how the fact that there are sudden increases in the number of AIDS patients seems to depend upon rewriting the definition of AIDS rather than doctors finding more cases. We will begin, one, with a nod to Bacon, Francis Bacon, by looking at this confusing definition, seeing that lack of a firm agreement on what AIDS is makes it all the harder to accurately calculate the number of affected. Then we will see, two, how when the amount of AIDS patients suddenly show an unexpected spurt, it may be attributable to a manipulation of this unstable definition or to other paper juggling. Then we will look further into, three, the implications of this paper amplification to see how they affect other parts of the AIDS doctrine. First, let's begin with a muddy definition. Bacon names the fourth obstacle to objective perception in his work, Idols of the Marketplace. These are, quote, idols which have crept into the understanding through the alliances of words and names. For men believe that reason governs words. It is also true that words react in a distorting manner upon the understanding, unquote. This can happen in manifold ways. But for us, Bacon's most pertinent example is, quote, there are names of things which exist, but yet confused and ill-defined and hastily irregularly derived from realities, unquote. He takes the word humid as an example of this, showing that, chameleon-like, it alters its meaning according to the situation which it's found. The great danger is that a reasoner will imagine that because humid is the same five-letter word every time it is employed, the idea behind it has the same inflexibility. This thinker will then blithely ignore the gyrations of humid's meaning as it moves from content to context. My extrapolation here is that researchers' inability to settle on a single set definition of AIDS is behind many problems in examining the syndrome, including settling on how many people actually have the disease. Let me just give you a parenthetical example. there was a man who came to my office when I had put the word out that I was doing a study on those who had been diagnosed with full-blown AIDS, not just HIV positivity, who had ARC or one of the other 30 different conditions at some advanced stage. One man presented with 24 of the 30 symptoms. Remarkable that he was even alive. In fact, he had just come from St. Vincent's Hospital where they didn't think he would pull through. He had been in intensive care. He brought his medical records. He had been seen over 100 times by physicians, and he was in some of the AIDS core support groups. By taking each of the conditions separately that he suffered from and showing a way of rebalancing those one at a time, in under a year, he seroconverted to HIV negative. He had no opportunistic infections. He was completely well. Now, according to the legend of the HIV philosophy, that's not possible. But it was possible. It happened. So does that mean he did not have AIDS and did not have HIV? But they said he did have HIV. He had dozens of tests showing his titers. And he had all these other conditions due to the HIV. But at no point was HIV ever approached. He simply had his body's immune system, condition by condition, properly administered to. Now, if he represented the average person having AIDS, and if a holistic approach that had nothing to do with treating the virus was successful, as it was with him, with other people, and it was indeed with other people, I took these people on Tony Brown's journal with before and after medical reports, etc., then that would have meant that the basic idea that this person had HIV causing these diseases was wrong. Of course, when he said he had a background of using intravenous drugs at enormous levels had hepatitis and he had multiple sexually transmitted diseases, syphilis, multiple times, his doctor said that had nothing to do with it. It was this virus. So therefore, his smoking, his drinking, his use of antibiotics every single day to prevent sexually transmitted diseases, which doesn't work anyhow, but it destroys the immune system. Well, when he was no longer on these antibiotics, he overcame his thrush. Thrush was one of the 30 conditions that they describe as AIDS. And when he started eating properly, he had been living off junk food. He was a junk foodaholic and 30 cups of coffee a day. When he was given proper, just proper nutrition, his wasting and cachexia stopped. When his body was detoxified and he was giving fresh green vegetable juices and proper vitamin supplements, his liver rebalanced. And he no longer had active hepatitis. Interesting. Not one doctor that he went back to, not one researcher, not one hospital was at all interested in the fact that he was totally well. In fact, one of his previous doctors that had been treating him for some time claimed then he must never have had AIDS to begin with. And he said, but you're the one who did all the tests. You took the blood serum. We have it frozen. You're the one who gave me all these reports. You're the one who gave me all these treatments. You're the one who put me in the hospital twice. Are you saying you did all that because of gross negligence on your part? That's medical malfeasance. Well, of course, the doctor wouldn't agree to that, just that he must not have had it, because if he had it, he couldn't have gotten over it by just these lifestyle changes, because that would have upset the paradigm. That's just giving an example of what I'm talking about, just by meaning, labeling. Let's begin by asking why a single definition has not been agreed on. Dr. Serge Lang sees the lack of a scientific consensus on precisely what constitutes AIDS as due to the multiple factors, including lack of institutional agreement and the theoretical difficulty, already noted, that arises when two people can die in exactly the same way from the same disease and yet be classified as dying from different illnesses. One problem is that the different institutions have alternate ideas of how AIDS should be characterized. Lang states, quote, there does not even exist a single proper definition of AIDS on which discourse or statistics can reliably be based. Some statistics from some sources are based upon the CDC definition, while others are not, he states, unquote. Quote, what good are statistics obtained or reported under such circumstances? since what one source would classify as AIDS, another would not. Thus, for example, if two institutions with contrasting definitions of the illness studied the same patients, they would end with different reckonings on how many had AIDS. Not just that, but how to treat AIDS. Just as I were to show you, by offering a proper nutritional program, the person I work with overcame all of the AIDS conditions. But that's because I did not accept AIDS as what he was suffering from. I accepted that he was suffering from a compromised immune system, that he had to stop everything that was compromising it, smoking. His doctors never told him to stop smoking, drinking, he was still drinking, using drugs, he was still on drugs. His doctors never had him do any of that. They were looking for all the medical interference within that disease process. It was actually contributing to his disease process. Therein the difference of how you're labeled. Labeled as being nutritionally deficient, you get a non-toxic regimen. Being labeled as AIDS, you get a toxic regimen where you virtually cannot distinguish the difference between AIDS and its symptoms and the drugs given to treat it. Such lack of congruity between definitions is only to be expected. Lange argues because diseases which are said to arise once AIDS has weakened the immune system are so disparate. About 60% are ones like tuberculosis that are connected to immunodeficiency. The other 40%, including cancers such as cervical cancer, are not connected to immune deficiency. This schizophrenic definition has prompted John Lawrenson to lash out at the definition as, quote, so absurd because the diseases have nothing in common. Although the central idea of AIDS is immune deficiency, he states some of the AIDS indicator diseases like cancers, wasting, and dementia have nothing whatsoever to do with immune deficiency, unquote. What unites these diseases is HIV. Quote, the CDC calls these diseases AIDS only when antibodies against HIV are confirmed or presumed to be present. If a person tests HIV negative, then the diseases are given another name, unquote. AIDS, said to be caused by a parasite, can only survive by leaching off host cells. It is also the illness that gains most of its hallmarks by taking them from other diseases. As John Lawrenson notes, quote, other diseases such as mumps, measles, polio, chickenpox, rabies, and so on can readily be described and diagnosed. Not AIDS, which is defined entirely in terms of other old diseases, unquote. However, the inability of AIDS to stand on its own would not necessarily hinder scientists from arriving at agreement on how to define it. The perplexity is that there is contention over what diseases should be associated with AIDS. If we look just at the CDC definition as an instance of this, we see that it has kept expanding. Dr. Robert Root Bernstein has traced the dramatic changes that took place in the earliest period, beginning in 1984, the CDC revised this definition by adding to the list of diseases diagnostic for AIDS as lymphoma, cancer of the lymph system, limited to the brain. It also made other adjustments. This was before HIV's role was identified. Once HIV was considered the only cause of AIDS, there was, quote, a second revision in June 1985. To the previous set of 14 diseases predictive of cellular immune suppression, and the CDC added 7 more diseases. It would seem sensible to reclassify patients once it was believed that HIV causes AIDS. I have no quarrel with the logic there. However, the significant point to be brought up fully later is that sudden explosions in the number of AIDS patients are frequently due to changes on paper, that is, to altering of the list of associated diseases. Rather than, as the media suggested, the sudden uncovering of a new multitude of sick people. And I'll use it separate paradigm. You had no attention deficit disorder, no ADHD, until you had a drug to treat it, Ritalin. And suddenly you started an exponential increase by definition. So if a child rides a skateboard across rough terrain, now they can be listed as having ADD. If you ask a question before your hand goes up, now you can be listed as ADD. In fact, the newest definition of ADD, they've expanded it to include some 270 different criteria, making it virtually possible for every single child in America to be labeled now with ADD. So when the news prints that we've had a 500% increase in cases diagnosed with ADD, it's not because we've had 500% new people suffering from it. It's just they've increased the definition of who could fall into the category being classified. They can do the same thing with adults. In fact, I saw an ad, I couldn't believe it, about 3 o'clock this morning. I was watching some of the news, and an ad came on for Paxil, which shows that they're now classifying someone who is shy as having a disease. That shyness is now considered a psychiatric condition. And therefore, Paxil, a medication, can help you with it. It doesn't allow you to make friends. It just allows you not to feel the loneliness of your shyness. Well, how absurd. But no one's going to question it. Many people will look at it and say, good, they finally have something that will help shy people or people having trouble meeting people. The scientists won't question it. Physicians offering it won't question it. Pharmacists selling it won't question it. People using it won't question it. Another paradigm that expands the definition of mental illness. And therefore, later this year, someone from the National Institutes of Mental Health will go before Congress, one of the Appropriations Committees, and say, we need $5 billion more to our budget because we have an epidemic of new mental illness. Now, maybe, just maybe, one of the legislators will say, which one? Shyness. Okay, you're a scientist. I'm not. I'm just a politician. Here's your $5 billion. And so it goes. That's how we end up with 30 conditions that we now call AIDS. It would seem sensible to reclassify patients based upon this, but it's not. Let's go back. Let's go forward to this. Rocketing numbers, partly prompted by elastic definitions and other statistical and record-keeping processes, is going on. After rehearsing the fact that reporters, health officials, university professors, and medical doctors advance the impression that each year more Americans become HIV positive and develop AIDS than the year before, Dr. Philpott makes the following startling claim. The impression these experts are giving is false. He says, quote, the fraction of Americans who are HIV positive has never increased since testing began in 1985. And since 1993, the number of new AIDS diagnoses reported each year has been fewer than the year before for all groups, including women, blacks, heterosexuals, and young adults, unquote. Now, the listener must already suspect that the plausibility of Philpott's claim rests on the way increasing numbers have been appearing as a result of redefinitions and other paper manipulations. In 1993, a new definition of people with AIDS was instated by the CDC so that it now included, quote, any person who had developed a significant loss of T helper lymphocytes, unquote. Now think of that for a moment. Are you aware that stress will lower your T helper lymphocytes? That long distance training, running a marathon, will bring you down to the level of a person with AIDS? Yes, there are. Hepatitis will drop it down. All forms of hormonal imbalances will drop it down. Naturally occurring biological processes could lower your T helper cells. But overnight, millions of Americans were made susceptible to being diagnosed as AIDS simply because they had a lower T helper lymphocyte count. As Dr. Ruth Bernstein explains, a healthy person ought to have 1,000 of these cells per cubic milliliter of blood. When the T cell count falls below 200, per cubic milliliter blood, then by the new definition, the person has AIDS. This was a stunning departure from previous definitions in that formerly a person wasn't said to have AIDS until their first AIDS-defining illness. But by the new definition, anybody who is HIV positive and has a CDC 4 count below 200 now is told, you have AIDS. Now listen to this. You could be completely healthy. You could be the world's greatest athlete. You could be dynamic on every level, but if you had a flu vaccine, if you had arthritis, if you had herpes, if you had allergies, and you took an HIV antibody test, first there's a high probability you're going to test a positive, even though you have no AIDS, HIV, and secondly, You could have a low T count, below 200, and then your doctor's going to say, you have AIDS. You say, no, I'm healthy. No, you have AIDS. Take a look at me. I'm healthy. No, you have AIDS, and therefore we must start you on AZT. The person goes on ACT, and about 2 years later, they're dead because the ACT killed them. It's hard to imagine, but this is what's happening every single day. The CDC argued that the new definition was needed because due to antiviral drugs and other improved treatments, quote, people are going longer without developing infections. So the definition was broadened in an attempt to include all people whose health was threatened because their T-cell count had dropped. That makes about as much sense as saying that the Titanic sunk due to too much water in the Atlantic. As could be expected, quote, implementation of the new definition artificially boosted the number of AIDS cases reported on the national AIDS statistics at least 250%. That is, by in 1993, medical status of about 36,000 asymptomatic HIV-positive Americans was changed on purely formal basis. They became AIDS patients only because of the new definition of AIDS. These people were healthy. They had nothing wrong with them. They were probably testing false positives because of medications they were taking. Pregnancy will test you false positive. 63 reasons, conditions will give you a false positive. And then even when you retest, you'll test false positive. So if you had had a hepatitis, you'll test positive more often than not. If you had had allergies or taking allergy medicines, all these things will test you positive. So a normal, healthy person gets a positive reading but has no symptoms. Now, by having low T-cell count, which is not indicative of a bad immune system, how do I know that? I tested over 100 of our vegetarian, completely healthy, dynamically healthy marathon runners a week before and a week after the New York City Marathon 4 years ago, and almost all of them had under 200 T-cells. That would have automatically meant that they had, in the presence of HIV antibody, they would have been labeled as AIDS. That is how precariously people stand on this whole definition. I'm Gary Noy. I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time for this particular hour. I will continue on our next program, which will be part 7 of AIDS, A Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth. If you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346, program number 2637. Have a nice day, everyone.